This is Ask the Investigator, the podcast that navigates the high seas of professional investigation, gives the warning signs of when it's time to stop being your own Dick Tracy and call a professional, and offers tips on what to do before making that call to help your cause. Now, here's your host, Ken Cummins.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the initial podcast of Ask the Investigator. That was the band Bowman's Prendon that was doing our background music there. I am a former journalist on sabbatical and have been an investigator for 30 years and have owned my and managed my own company for most of that time. I will be your host on this voyage each week. Joining me will be Christian Duvall, my right-hand man, who's sitting on the right hand of me right now, and he's been with me on many of our adventures together. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
Are you glad to be here?
I'm thrilled, delighted, and honored to be here.
You always say that you enjoy being an investigator, a private investigator. Why do you? What is it you like about it?
Well, what I like about it is no day was ever the same. It could be one day hopping on a plane, going to Mexico to a prison or to interview an inmate, or it could be wearing a mask and conducting a surveillance, following individuals throughout the city, or going to a crime scene and gather fingerprints. And no day was the same. It was a lot of action, and I absolutely loved it.
Okay, well, we'll get more into those stories in a little bit, but now on my left side, and with us each week will be Tish Few, who was an excellent surveillance investigator for me for a period. She's now in the corporate world, but she's going to be with us every week to keep us on topic, on target, and on time. Hello, Tish.
Hello, Ken. It's always nice working with you. And since I'm your co-host in this adventure, yes, let's start with the first question.
Okay.
All right. So what type of investigations are the most common?
Well, I would say for us, the most common is background investigations. We do, because that can be a part of litigation support, that can be part of mergers and acquisitions, that can be pre-employment. You know, you really got to know the background of your partners. Maybe you've met somebody at a bar you think you want to marry, but you don't know if this person is telling you the truth. So background investigation would be the most common. And I want to say at the outset here, there are two types of investigators, licensed and unlicensed. And you do not want to hire an unlicensed investigator, because licensed, we're vetted, we've got the proper insurance, we've met all the regulation requirements. And if you hire an unlicensed one, you're going to end up with a cowboy who may do anything and cause you more problems than he actually helps you.
And I would also add that being licensed gives you the advantage. It gives you credibility when you testify in court or when you're involved in court proceedings. We know how to maintain a chain of custody. We know how to acquire information legally so that it's admissible in a court of law.
Okay. Yes. Let's get a little bit into criminal investigations. Christian, you talked about Mexico earlier. If you can just give us some background on what happened in that case.
Well, it was one of the biggest international drug cartel investigation one of the U.S. city's history. And it involved going to Mexico to a prison, and a very dangerous prison where a few years ago guards had been overtaken, RPGs, walls had been blown up, and prisoners had escaped. So it was housing some quite a dangerous individuals. And I had to enter the prison and interview an inmate. And when you enter a Mexican prison, it's not as in a U.S. prison where you are under protection of correctional officers and you might have a glass or I was actually in the middle of the courtyard surrounded by inmates. And, you know, I asked to speak to such and such and said, yes, he's actually in his cell currently cooking.
Yeah.
That implies he probably has access to knives and, you know, all
so
sorts
he's
of
cooking food.
Cooking food, okay. Exactly.
Not drugs.
Not cooking drugs. Okay, I didn't know.
Or he could have been, for all I know.
That's a good point. This was a criminal defense case where we were hired by the attorneys for the defendant who'd been arrested and extradited from Mexico to here. And, you know, in a case, in a criminal offense, the government has all its resources on one side, and the defendant only has what they can afford privately or what their attorneys can arrange. And we were, one of our main tasks was to find out where the information about this guy came from, who the sources were, what their motives, what kind of deals they got, et cetera. So it was quite an interesting case.
Now, Ken, can you tell us a little bit about serving?
Subpoenas. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, this is actually one of the most dangerous areas, I think, in private investigations. And where you got to serve a subpoena if it's, or some subpoena if it's a criminal case, summons if it's a civil case, and the case won't go forward if you cannot effect service of process. It's the thing that the attorneys always want to pay the least for, but if you don't get it done, your case is thrown out of court. And in these instances, we've had people pull guns on us, threaten to get into fights. So I don't really consider private investigations work, what we do to be that dangerous. But we, our most dangerous times and most difficult spots have been when serving subpoenas, right?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, I had a story where we had to serve a very high-level executive of an international organization, and he had evaded service, and we tried to finally intercept it as he was pulling into his garage. And he had bodyguards and a chauffeur, and so one of my investigators got right in front of the car to try to stop it, and the car almost ran him over. So he actually stuck the papers on the handle of the car. And so you'll have people who are in very desperate situations, who are desperate not to pay or not to not be involved in a lawsuit, and they'll do whatever it takes to evade. I mean, I remember another day when I was on a utility pole wearing a construction worker helmet and pretending to be working on a pole when, in fact, I was looking at the residence of a suspect, and he actually crawled like a snake trying to escape and evade us. So people will get very creative.
And then you had the incident in the neighborhood over here.
That's right. I was in Nanny Burrow, one of the neighborhoods there in Washington, D.C., and I was in a bright car, which was with Virginia tags, which was not the best move, and they they noticed that I did not belong in the neighborhood, and I had projectiles thrown on the car, and then I had individuals approach me saying it was going to get really hot for me unless I left. So. Yes, it can be quite dangerous.
That's definitely one of the things with surveillance. You have to blend in. So I'm sure you guys then pushed a lot more people out into the street and handled that case.
Oh, yeah.
Well, usually what we would do is we look at the type of neighborhoods we're going to. Then we're going to get a car that matches the type of cars which are parked in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And we will try to remain as inconspicuous as we can. However, in that case, we rented a car, and that was the only rental car available. It was a bright blue car with Virginia tags. I stuck out.
Yeah,
I want to tell one more story about serving because this is my favorite. There was a businessman who had a big judgment against him, a lawsuit where he would end up with a big judgment against him, and he fled to the Congo. But we got word that he was coming back when the president of Congo came here to visit, that he was going to be part of his entourage surrounded by the president's security. And I managed to finagle my way into a speech that the president was giving at the Mayflower Hotel. And I saw the guy walk out the side door after the speech was ended, and he went into a private elevator to go up. And I just managed to run out the front door and run around to the side, and here he was come walking down the sidewalk. And so I addressed him, and he said, yes. And then I said, you've been served. And he turned around at that time, and I put the papers on his shoulder, and he flipped them back over. And I caught him and chased him to the car. Well, the driver thought that we were both running to get into the car, so he held the car door open for me, and I threw in the papers and said, you've been served, and then walked away.
That's hilarious. Well, let's transition a little bit. Let's talk about individuals. When individuals hire investigators, what do they hire them for? What are the most common cases in that? Individuals meaning private citizens.
Private citizens. Well, usually that's what we call domestic cases. That's usually a cheating partner, cheating spouse. You know, their husband or the wife's going to be in D.C. for a conference. They found something on the cell phone, some text or something that indicates there's something going on, and they want us to get to the bottom of that, of what it is. And that mostly involves surveillance. But asset searches, which we're going to talk about more, or collecting on your court judgments, we're going to talk about, which we're going to talk about more in this show. That's a common one too, where people get they go to court, they sue somebody, and they get a judgment, and then they say, "Now what I do?" And you know, it's up to them to find the assets and to collect on it, and that's a difficult thing. And then, of course, what you mentioned earlier, background investigations. If you're hiring a nanny, you're hiring a construction company to renovate your house, you're got a business, you're hiring a new employee, you want to go and partner with somebody in a business arrangement, you want to check them out first, you're going to mergers, acquisitions. So I'd say those are pretty common, and those can stretch from just, you know, the person looking for a criminal background check on an individual that's going to be in their household, up to a company wanting to hire a top-level executive.
I would add skip traces. Skip traces locating individuals as well. And I would also add, we've had quite a few adoption cases where people wanted us to identify and locate their parent, sister, brother. We've had quite a few of those as well.
Okay. Well, today's episode is dedicated to asset recovery.
Yes.
So, Christian, can you tell us a little bit about asset searches before you have a judgment?
Well, absolutely. So, usually asset searches involve individuals who wish to settle personal injury cases, collect debt. It could be a child support case or a divorce case. And there are several stages. There's a prejudgment, and the prejudgment of an asset search is when we have to identify the assets that could be seized in a potential lawsuit, right? What we want to make sure is, for the defendant wants to make sure, is it worth pursuing or suing an individual? Are there assets? Is it, because a lawsuit is expensive. It costs a lot of money. And then you have collecting on a judgment, and that's once the court has issued a default order or judgment. Unfortunately, it's up to the creditor to collect on the debt, even though there's a judgment. And in this case, you have different types of assets that we'll look at. We'll look at what you call tangible personal property assets, and that could be real properties, that could be financial accounts, meaning bank accounts, stocks, bonds, etc. And then you have personal property that includes aircraft, watercraft, cars, RVs, and...
Yeah, one of the most common things we get are from attorneys who, you know, they've got a client who was in a car accident, which wasn't their fault. They've got $100,000 in medical bills, and they've got a $40,000 insurance policy on the table, and they want to know, do they have to take this policy, or is there something else out there? And so, you know, we do what we call the quick basic asset search. We see that the driver is a 29-year-old who lives in his parents' basement and drives a 1993 Honda Civic, saying, no, there are no assets there. We can pretty much assure you of that. But if we find that the driver is a 43-year-old businessman, and he's got some he owns his own house, and he owns a beach house, and he owns property somewhere else, then it's worth continuing the search.
Interesting. I mean, I know there's also situations where you can garnish wages and so on and so forth.
Yeah. That's collecting. And, you know, as you'll hear from our guest this evening or this week, she got a judgment. But Nat, you know, the easiest thing to do is to get the judgment. The hardest thing to do is to collect it, and that can take years.
Excellent.
So I would say we are right now. We're in an era where we're getting a lot of sexual harassment cases. Going back to different type of cases, that's the flavor of the month right now. And we're going to do an entire episode on that. Because right now there really is no definition of what is sexual harassment. And then we get some political cases. People want to know, you know, we've got a new administration in town which is appointing people nobody ever heard of before. And lobbyists want us to find out, who are these people? What is their background? How do we approach them?
Excellent. You know,
so things like that. Anytime you need information or you're trying to find somebody, that's when an investigator can be a valuable help to you.
Excellent. Well, we're going to transition here, and for privacy reasons, we will not use our next guest's last name, but her first name is Chris, and we will be back with her after a word from our sponsors.
Great.
Support for Ask the Investigator comes from Capital Inquiry, a full-service private investigations firm that has been conducting investigations nationally and internationally for 3 decades. If you need help searching for assets, birth parents in the case of adoption, or background checks on a future spouse, nanny, employee, home renovator, or business partner, go to capinc.com. That is CAPINQ.com, or email us at info@capinc.com. Now we are going to hear a real life struggle from Chris. Ken, would you like to introduce Chris?
Yes, Chris is joining us on the line today. Thank you, Chris, for being available. She came to me a few years ago. She'd had a judgment for quite a while, and she hadn't been able to collect on it, so she decided she wanted to ramp up the effort again, and so she called us. And then, Chris, I'm going to let you explain what the case is all about.
Thank you for the opportunity to share my story, and hopefully maybe it will help others down the road. You never know, right?
Right.
Once upon a time, met a guy, got married, bought a townhouse, and unfortunately, as the way some things sometimes go, our marriage wasn't working out, and through the separation process, I wanted to divest of the townhouse, and he did not. So he came up with a partner to buy me out of the townhouse. We went through and signed all sorts of different types of agreements where they gave me a lump sum of cash for my buyout of it. And in return, we had an agreement that they would refinance the house within a period of XY period of time and to get my name off the deed. Divorce goes through. We all move on. Number of years later, I meet another gentleman, and we get married, and we want to now buy a house. And in the process of going through and getting pre-qualified, I discover I have a foreclosure on my credit report. And, you know, keep in mind, this is a while ago, so this is before they now recommend you check your credit report every year. Et cetera. And it wasn't on all, but it was on 2 of the 3. Excuse me. So I, of course, quickly try to figure out what's going on. And as the story, you know, as I peel back the onion on this, I discover that basically my ex had stopped paying on the townhouse and let it go into foreclosure. And they had never gone through and removed my name from the deed. So now I'm in the situation of how do I solve this, because I was not legally responsible for the house, but I have to prove that to the mortgage company and the credit card company, the credit bureaus. So I had to hire a lawyer. We had to go to court. We got a judgment against my ex, and we were able to do that because in addition to the other third-party agreements we signed, it was also in the property settlement agreement, so I had some good attorneys from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to get a judgment against him for breach of contract.
And would you agree that, as most my clients tell me, getting the judgment is the easiest thing, part of this process?
Yes, it was crystal clear what the parties were supposed to do, and it was crystal clear they had not performed in accordance with the requirements of the contract. So therefore, they were found in breach of contract, and I got a judgment. That was the easy part. It was expensive because you have to pay attorneys to go through all of this and do, you know, their due diligence, and they, you know, try to find them and serve them and all that stuff.
And then what happened after you got the judgment?
Got the judgment, but you couldn't find them, you know, and it became, you know, it's difficult and it's very expensive. And, you know, keep in mind that this judgment was done a while ago, so technology has certainly, you know, improved insofar as being able to track people down, but there are individuals that tend to live off the grid or as much off the grid as they possibly can, and, you know, he was one of them, and he was pretty successful at it, and so it made it very difficult to find him, and he moved. He had a job that would allow him to jump from state to state with some ease. So I was finally in a position that I could afford a more exhaustive search, and so that's when I hired Ken's company to go and really try to find this individual. because now, you know, the judgment plus the interest is now, you know, it was always a sizable sum, but it was now even more sizable. And so Ken's organization was able to locate the individual, you know, my ex, living in another state. And then I had to still go and spend more money to, get local counsel. And that's when I discovered that based on the state, and this is true, not all states are like this, but some states have these statutes that say that if somebody's been a resident of their state, an established residency for 10 years, then judgments from other states cannot be collected against them. Now, if he were to move to another state where that judgment, you know, then where they don't have that law, then I could enforce the collection. But getting the judgment is the easiest thing. Enforcing the collection, finding them, and then even trying to get it enforced is very difficult because in the case of Ken's company, they helped me by finding, assets, because finding the person and then doing the asset search are two different things. And then there's a whole protocol that really favors the individual more so than it favors, the person that owes the money than it favors the person who's trying to collect it, as far as going after the asset.
It sounds like you've been at this for about 20 years or so.
Almost.
<Yeah. laughs>
And the nice thing is my judgment can be renewed, and it will continue to collect interest.
But you
have to be in a position of, A, where that person is. They have to have the assets, and then you have to be able to attach,
right,
or claim the assets.
And your situation, your story, is very typical of a lot of cases that we get where a person has been, they're trying to collect child support. Maybe they loan somebody some money to start a business, and they never started the business. They hired a home renovator, a home contractor to do work on their house. They paid him up front, and then he disappeared. They're not big judgments, and the people who are responsible for paying these judgments, their strategy is to make it so expensive and so difficult that you finally give up. And I guess that's what you found.
Yeah, I would, there's a part of you that never leaves the back of your mind, but, kind of the household becomes, I've got other things I've got to take care of that are more pressing. You know, financially, it's expensive to find the people. I mean, it was expensive. I clearly got a judgment, an award for dollars for the money I was out to get the initial judgment. Then I've got to spend more dollars to find the person, only to find that I really can't collect against it.
Yeah.
And I find that very frustrating. I wish the states would get together. I think they're moving a little bit in that direction when it comes to child support, right? But I think in general on judgments, I wish they would all get together, establish the same, respect where the judgments are coming from, not have statutes there that say, you can't collect for this person because it's been 10 years. I mean, if the judgment's good, it's good. It's a valid judgment. And they should recognize that some of these people are deliberately hiding assets and moving around for the sole purpose of not repaying it. Not because maybe they don't have the money, it's just that they, some of them are not honorable, they don't have good intentions, and they just want to stick it to that, dirty rotten bastard or that, mean bitch, and that's the person they once loved and married, so it's just amazing how that works.
Now, Chris, what would you have done in retrospect, looking at the situation you were in? Obviously, the marriage, but we're not going to discuss this. What would you have done in retrospect?
In retrospect, I probably should have paid more attention and follow up after the agreements were, after we had the agreements in place to ensure that they followed through on what they were supposed to do. There were other factors in the marriage that led me to wanting to put a lot of distance between myself and my ex. But I would say if a factor that you're not afraid of that person doesn't exist, then probably I would recommend that the people try to maintain some level of contact so you can keep tabs on where that person is. We didn't have social media when I got the original judgment like it is today. So, you know, there's a lot that, you know, can be gleaned off of social media. People just love to talk about themselves. But in this particular case, I don't think that would really help because, you know, some people that just like to stay off the grid.
Yeah.
You know, pretty well.
Right. You were talking about, I'm sorry,
go ahead.
To interrupt you, but you were talking about keeping track of these people. So are you talking about some kind of a registry, or a court registry, or some state by state that if you get an outstanding judgment, there's somewhere that you can go and look up this person's name and see what what's leans against him?
I mentioned it before. I think it would be, I think for, and for child support people too, but anybody who has a judgment placed against them, I think as part of that judgment, it should be a requirement that they register with the court their whereabouts until that judgment is paid. I mean, there's been, you know, if you go to court and there's clearly a judgment in the court of law that's made, then they owe something, you know, to an individual in the community. And I understand that they're not criminal per se, but they have had a judgment placed against them, and I think that there should be some kind of registry that they have to check in their whereabouts so that people can, you know, determine or assess the collectability of that.
Right. So before we let you go, what would you have any advice to other people, women especially, who are in your position, who have gotten themselves in the position you were in?
You know, I'd say if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. And the one thing I'm thankful for is that I had good lawyers that helped me put these types of things in writing. The one thing I guess I would do is try to encourage people to seek legal counsel as, you know, as quickly and as efficiently as you can. And to not probably let so much time lapse. You know, I know that's hard because a lot of people struggle paycheck to paycheck. But if you are owed something, then, you know, I don't think that there's anything illegal about posting things and kind of trying to maybe shame people into doing it, right? I mean, it's a public judgment.
Right.
It's out there on the books. So there's a thought there from that perspective, too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Chris. We really want to thank you for telling your story. And all I would say is keep after it. I think one day you're going to be able to collect.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate all your help, and thank you for allowing me to share it. Hopefully it helps somebody.
Okay. Thank you.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, Ken, I think what we've learned from Chris is, first of all, everyone should go under a background check if they're going to get married. And number two, you definitely...
That's certainly romantic, you know.
Well, I mean, background check, you know, prenup, so all those things.
You propose, and you say, and by the way, can I have your fingerprints?
So exactly.
We've had a lot... I mean, joking aside, we've had a lot of parents ask that we conduct a background investigation on their child's fiancé.
Right.
It happens a lot. You'd be surprised.
And that's legal.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
It's very legal.
Yeah. We will.
So everyone should do it.
If we stray from the legal side, practices, we're risking our license, and we're not going to do that.
Exactly. Well, she was great. Next, we will discuss this case after a word from our sponsor.
Okay.
Support for Ask the Investigator comes from Capital Inquiry, a full-service private investigations firm that has been conducting investigations nationally and internationally for 3 decades. If your law firm is handling a complex litigation that relies on developing information and witnesses, or you need to know the credibility of a plaintiff, defendant, expert witness, or your own client, go to capinc.com, that is capinq.com, or email us at info@capinc.com.
I know you're going to accuse me
we didn't solve this.
Go ahead.
Well, first I have to say people get pretty crafty, right?
People get
pretty crafty in the situations. Like she said, he just thought she was a jerk and he wasn't going to pay her, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
But why do people get so crafty? I mean, she claimed a couple of things, but is it because they can't afford it, or is it really because they're so angry, or they just don't care?
Well, you see this a lot in child support cases where as soon as the father gets a judgment against him, a warrant or you know, an order to pay. He quits his job and finds a job where he gets paid under the table. And it's anger. They don't want to. They don't want to be stuck with this debt. Recent case we had was a woman. It's similar to this. She met a man. They had a whirlwind marriage. After the marriage, she found out he was really from old money and he had a lot of money, but that his mother controlled all the purse strings. After 12 years and three children, they decided they had grown apart, and so they had an amicable divorce. He paid child support until he met another woman and got married, and his new wife didn't want him to pay the child support. So he stopped paying, and he moved assets into her name. He moved assets out of the country, and she spent a lot of money and a lot of time collecting, and then finally had to agree to a settlement or a mediation that was cost her about $150,000 of what she was owed. She had to agree to accept that. Otherwise, the fight would just gone on and on. So okay. Some of it's pride. They just don't want to pay, I guess.
So, Ken, yeah, we're going to go back to your original assumption. How was this a success story for Chris? Didn't you fail? I mean, she didn't collect. Where did we get with that case?
We didn't fail. There are actually three parts of this. You got to get the judgment, which we said is the easiest part. Then you got to find the assets. And in her case, we found real estate and we found bank accounts with plenty of money in it. But then the third part is collecting. Once you identify the assets, you got to go in and seize them. And that's the part that hasn't succeeded yet. But I think if her attorney gets a little more aggressive and keeps after him, she'll eventually get something. So no, this was not a failure. We consider this one of our successes.
Now, Christian, what are some of the teaching moments from this case?
Well, some of the teaching moments, obviously, from nowadays, people have access to their credit report. In fact, everybody has access to a free credit report a year from O3 Reporting, Credit Reporting Bureau. So it's important to to pull up your credit report and identify any inconsistencies. Is there anything fraudulent taking place? Or in her case, if that had been available at that time, she would have been able to tell, oh, this is not authorized, or this deal never closed as we agreed. And also, it's important whenever you have a legal case or a proceeding, or you're told that property will be, your name will be taken off, follow up. Make sure you follow up. I think that's important.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting that she said she hadn't checked her credit report in 10 years or so, but you've got to. I think the thing and she got this judgment and she let it sit for a while. One of the things I would say when you get a judgment, move quickly. Don't let it sit around. Collect on it. Try to close the deal right then. You know, a judgment is going to expire after 12 years. And after 12 years, if her attorney had forgotten to refile that judgment, refresh it, she wouldn't have had no standing. Wouldn't have had any standing. That was a better way to say it. So you've got to be aware of that. Now, like we said earlier, there's if you're in the prejudgment stage, we can look for real estate, tangible properties, but we cannot look for stocks and bank accounts until you get that judgment. And once you get that judgment, then that opens the door for us to go in and search. And we're not just searching for bank accounts in the name of the person who's the debtor. We're searching for bank accounts in anybody's name or any entity's name that person may be a signer on.
And I would add, we also identify liabilities, because you might locate an asset. However, there might be a lien. There might be a restriction. You might not be able to recover the entire value of the asset. So we're able to identify this as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we find real estate, we have to check and see, is it refinanced to the hilt, or is there equity in it? So that's one of our responsibilities to determine that. You know, and sometimes we're searching for assets that belong to somebody that they didn't even know were gone. Mm-hmm. For instance, we had a defense contractor, and one day he got a call from the bank and said, you know, so-and-so was here cashing his paycheck on that account. I said, you know, there are about 35 people who cash paychecks on that account. And then they started looking at it, and their COO had created all these fictitious vendors, and they would cash their checks at a bank account in Virginia, and then they were shipping the money, putting them in another account, shipping it to Florida, and then all over the place, California. And that was actually kind of a fun case because we were tracking money all around the country.
So what about international banks? International banks, international property. How does that work?
Very slowly, that's very difficult. That works on your network, and we have a good international network. So if we're, for instance, if we're trying to get information out of, Panama, for instance, or Belgium, we are going to rely on our network investigators in that country who know the laws of that country, who know have the sources, who can help us figure it out. That's when it gets more expensive. But those tracking those assets is possible. It is possible. We can track assets when they move them outside the country. But it becomes a much more difficult, much more complex, and much more costly process. So your judgment's got to be in at least the six figures, preferably somewhere in the seven figures.
And in this case, you were working with Chris, but in some of these cases, you typically will work with a law firm?
We always try to work with the law firm. When clients come to us, we'll say, okay, but let's get your lawyer involved so we have the attorney-client privilege. We can protect our work product from any disclosure by an adversary. So, yeah, we always try to work with the law firms whenever possible.
Okay. Well, before we run out of time here, Ken, I would like to have you talk a little bit about the next episode. Our next episode will be focused on sexual harassment. And just tell us a little bit about who we're going to speak with.
Well, sexual harassment right now is being defined by the accuser. The closest thing we can give to a definition is that sexual harassment is whatever the offended party claims without any touching. If it becomes touching, there's any touching involved, then it's sexual assault. Then it's a criminal offense. But sexual harassment is a civil offense. And so we're going to be talking next week with Kim Foster, who used to be a police officer in Montgomery County, Maryland. And now she's a private investigator, and she specializes in a lot of these cases. But we're going to focus next time on sexual harassment on the university campus because we've had a number of cases dealing with that, and it's a very broad subject. You got sexual harassment on the university campus, sexual harassment in the workplace, and the reason we chose to start with that with the university campus because this is where a lot of young people are they're starting out their careers, and this is where they can make mistakes that affect the rest of their lives. So that'll be a very interesting episode. You want to add anything, Christian?
I think you've covered it all.
Yeah, we've had a number of very interesting cases with sexual harassment, so we'll be looking forward to handling that topic.
If you have any questions or comments or topics and would like us to consider them, please reach out to us at askinvestigator@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at #AskInvestigator.
Okay. And we should also thank our sponsor again and our band, Bowman's Prendon, for the music. And until next time.
You've been listening to Ask the Investigator. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to askinvestigator@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter at #AskInvestigator. Thanks for tuning in.